Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Ellen Brown. Ellen, from across the pond, not at home today. Many, many thousands of miles at home, but we're connected. I could hear that laugh sounding like it was coming from the other room where I live. Ellen, it's great to have you on. Let me just tell listeners about your two books, which I love to repeat every single time. We've talked so many times about Web of Debt and what an impact it made on me when I first read it. And the sequel to Web of Debt that is equally important, the book you call The Public Bank Solution, From Austerity to Prosperity. And I must say, Ellen, the article you wrote today, you know, on another relatively small country, when I first heard about the plight in Iceland and then in Cyprus, you know, I thought, well, and Ireland, too, back in 2008. You know, these are small countries. You know, let's worry about the big ones, not the small ones. And once I learned something about these countries, and I did write a little bit about Ireland myself way back several years ago, nothing in more recent times, I realized how important these countries are, because what happens there can happen anywhere. And that's exactly what is going on. And we have the Iceland example of a tiny country that dared to stand up against the hegemons. And I remember, if I got the quote right, I think it was Gordon Brown, who just dared Iceland to do what it ended up doing. And he called doing it an act of terrorism. It almost sounded just a little bit short of declaring war. Well, Iceland went ahead and did the responsible thing. And I haven't heard any bombs falling on Iceland lately. And, of course, Ellen, we both know that Argentina, way back in 2000, 2001 or so, in the eyes of the debt holders, welched on its debt, refused to repay its odious debt. And it got away with it. It paid back the amount it thought it could afford. Most of its debt holders took the deal. Some held out. They held out a long time. They realized that they could hold on forever and they'd end up getting nothing. So they finally came around and they got something. Any country can do this. They can be a big country. They can be a small country. And you wrote a marvelous article on Ireland, and I'll let you talk about it. But I'll make one comment. This article alone, and of course the other countries that are strapped with austerity, but you make the point so clearly in your new article that the worst thing to get out of a debt problem or a financial problem like these countries are in is to strap them in austerity. It's sort of like thinking you can get out of a hole, Ellen, by digging a deeper one. I think that's about as good an analogy as I can think of. But explain your article, and again, I think it's a very important one.
Thanks, Stephen. Great talking to you. I'm actually in Switzerland now, but I was in Ireland where I gave four presentations on public banking. And so that's how I kind of got steeped in their issues. But just recently, two more banks, there are only a handful of banks there in the first place, and two more banks have pulled out. So they don't have much in the way of banks left. All these things that they've done since 2008 to try to salvage the banking system haven't worked. So they need some alternative. They're really ripe for public banking, and that's, of course, always my proposed solution.
It's an obvious solution, Ellen.
But what happened to them, why they're in such particularly bad straits, is that in 2008, when their banks went under, the government just sort of glibly assumed all the debts of all their banks or guaranteed all the debts to everybody, like the bondholders who didn't even expect to get all their money back, but everybody's gotten paid off, and the taxpayers are left holding the bag. And the taxpayers, although in the news they sort of, conventional news, they report the economy is doing better, but the people are doing worse. There's a rash of foreclosures. The people are really mad now that they realized what's happened to them. I heard an interviewee today say that their debt is the equivalent of 75,000 euros per family, which is, it's like having another mortgage. And this is a debt that they are having to pay to bail out their banks. I mean, it's strictly for their banks. Before 2008, they were in surplus. And after that, they went into the deepest deficit of any of the EU countries. And it was because of this huge bank debt, which the government has assumed. But they can't really, they could now arguably do what Iceland did and do what Argentina did and Ecuador did, just walk away from their debt or just say it's odious and they're not going to pay it. But the trouble is they borrowed from the EU, the IMF, and the Troika, you know, the ECB, EU, and IMF. They borrowed from them to pay off the banks or to pay the debts of the banks. So now instead of just owing a debt to a bank where you can just default and say, we don't have the money, sorry. Now they owe it to the big honchos in the Eurozone, and those are that's the group that's imposing austerity on them. I mean, they had to agree to this deal where they would have 4 years of austerity, and every budget cycle, they have to lay off more people and sell off more assets. But they've come to the point where the people are finally realizing what happened to them, and the people are balking, and they're not going to do it anymore. And it looks like they don't really have a viable banking system anymore. So they're ripe either to leave the Eurozone. I mean, it does look like that's what these particularly strapped countries are going to have to do. It's the only way to get out of those debts. There just isn't enough money in the whole Euro system to pay principal and interest, where all the money comes into circulation as a debt, where only the principal is advanced, and then they always owe more back than they borrowed. And where does that extra come from? The ECB is not allowing that extra into the system. So it's a flawed monetary model, and either they have to get out of that model, or if they're going to stay in and try to fight it in the meantime, what they can do is set up public banks, which would they could do like North Dakota did. So North Dakota, back in 1919, when their farmers were losing their farms to the Wall Street banks, they decided they wanted to keep their money at home. So they pulled their money out of the Wall Street banks. This is the state money, put it in their own state-owned bank. And then when you're a bank, what you get to do is you can lend out all that money, even though it's still there. That's the way banking works. It's the magic of banking, that you can lend out all your deposits, and yet your deposits are still there whenever you need to spend them. And the way that works is that they then borrow that money from other banks. I mean, if the depositors and the borrowers come for need the money at the same time, then the bank just borrows from the Fed funds, which are from other banks, or from the money market. So they borrow very cheaply, and then they get to lend it at much higher rates, and then they keep the spread. So that's the beauty of being a bank or having a bank, that you get the perks of a bank, which is you get to borrow at banker's rates instead of having to borrow on the open market at these quite high rates and having to worry about if you're a government that's under duress or stress, you have to worry about the rating agencies and interest rate swaps and all these derivatives scams that have actually, those alone have bankrupted some governments like Oakland and so that's the straits that they're in. And the good news is that they're, if you call it good news, is that they're sort of waking up to this situation, and they're in this sort of critical juncture where they might actually do something bold and take back their sovereignty, take back their power. They have a long history of being oppressed, but they also have a very dynamic spirit that goes back to the, I guess it's Celtic, but, you know, it goes back to, when we were there, we saw these ancient historic ruins that are actually older than the pyramids in Egypt. So a very ancient sort of mystical force that is the Irish, that if you can mobilize that and organize that and really get their get them all marching together, they could be a very strong force for change.
Boy, is the change ever needed, Ellen. Is the awakening because of the anger of the people that is affecting the political climate in the country, is that what's doing it?
Well, I think that what's really wakened them up was that early in the summer, I think there were these tapes that surfaced, which were about the bankers who were talking the government into guaranteeing their debts, and they were just joking about it and being quite crude and obviously just crooks. Somebody said that, you know, our bailout was $700 billion, and it was somebody asked, where'd you get the figure $700 billion? And he said, well, we just pulled it out of the air. I don't remember where I read that, but theirs was $7 billion. Their economy is like a 1/100th the size of ours, or their population, I guess, is 1/100th the size of ours. So their bailout was $7 billion, and the one guy asked the other, where'd you get the $7 billion figure? And he said, oh, I just pulled it out of my ass. So they're being totally flip. And so that obviously has made the Irish citizens very mad that this was not an honest, this was a crime. It was not merely a mistake on the part of the bankers who talked the government into it.
Oh, it's very easy for the bankers to talk the government into doing almost anything, Ellen. I mean, they work hand in glove with each other. It certainly is that way in America. It's that way in the major European countries. And whatever happens in Germany or France or Britain, Italy, I mean, that stuff can just cross border into other countries. I think what Ireland may need right now is a resurrection of St. Patrick. Well, St. Patrick, I believe, drove all the snakes out of Ireland many centuries ago, and I can't think of worse snakes than these banking crooks.
Ew, what a great image. I should have. Wish I had that for that article. I would have put that in there.
St. Patty is a big day in Chicago, Ellen. Chicago has, I believe, the largest population in the world outside of Dublin. And Boston, I think, is right next to it, my home city of Boston, and Chicago, where I live now. Well, we have a lot of snakes in Chicago. I mean, Chicago could use a resurrection of St. Patrick. But Ireland has first dibs. That's where he came from in the first place. And there certainly are a lot of snakes in the grass in Ireland, and it's high time something was done. I agree with you, Ellen, that sooner or later push is going to come to shove, not just in Ireland but in all these countries. You know, I mean, the worst of the debt problems and the rest of it are just buried under the carpet. You know, the mark-to-market rule just went by. It just got taken off the books. So the banks can have all this toxic debt on their balance sheets, and they don't have to declare any of it. So they can just begin with a clean slate. They get all this bailout money, whether it's Fed printing or from the ECB or whatever, and they can use that money not to conduct banking so much, but to speculate, to make more money, to buy up competition. And this is what's going on in 5 years. I remember in 2008 and 2009, I thought the roof was going to come in. I just couldn't imagine how on earth are we going to get out from under this without really having serious trouble. I suspected worse than anything in the 1930s, and I still suspect it, because you can keep this game going with all of these bailouts, QE, quantitative easing, and quantitative easing, as we know, would work marvelously if it was dropped on Main Street instead of on Wall Street. But on Wall Street, it does not go to grow the economy. It goes to enrich bankers, to give them money to make more of it, and they can only play this game so long. Sooner or later, I mean, even the Fed will realize, I think just about everybody else does, that they are not improving the economy by what they're doing. It's very fragile in America. It's very fragile in Europe. And they can, I don't know how long they can keep this game going. I couldn't believe they could do it as long as they have. Maybe they can do it another year or two or three. I don't know. But sooner or later, the music will stop. And heaven help, I would say, ordinary people most when it does. As bad as they're off today, I think it'll be much worse for them later on. The entire social safety net will go.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think what it takes first is for everybody to understand what's going on. So that's why I keep writing and you keep writing and talking.
Yes.
it's sort of a ferment that once you have enough people who understand, then you can get a real movement. I mean, one problem is that people don't, even though people see the problem and they see that something's rotten in the state of Denmark, we don't agree yet on the solution. Like you have all the, even in the money reform movement, there's many different movements and they disagree with each other and they tend to tear each other down. So at some point we have to have a clear vision of what the solution is or the best solution and actually go for that, it seems to me.
The only thing they need to do is to read Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen, and the solution is right there in black and white.
I was just reading about, or it was a reader who sent me about Costa Rica, that Costa Rica has a very strong, I think 75% public banking sector, and he said it that they were implemented 30 years ago when they had a big banking crisis, and at first all the banks went, they were publicly owned, and this worked really well. I mean, people realized how safe these banks were, that they were guaranteed by the government, and everybody put their money in it. I mean, they still do today. There's four big banks that are public sector banks, and by far they're the preferred by depositors. So these are ordinary banks, ordinary retail banks, not bankers' banks like the Bank of North Dakota is. Ordinary retail banks where they've got the bulk of the people's deposits, and therefore they have lots of credit power, and so people easily can get loans for homes and businesses and so forth. So they have lots of credit. It's kept their economy going very well, even though the IMF has leaned on them and the American or the Wall Street banks have leaned on them to privatize. But the people themselves are just not giving up these public banks. In fact, he said it's so taken for granted that if you tell them that in the U.S. you can't find any public banks, they just don't believe that, because it's so obvious that public banks work so much better, and they're better for the people, and they're better for the economy.
If that isn't a
great
lesson.
So that's going to be my next article.
Well, I think Costa Rica would be a marvelous article. You know, I think these are important, Ellen, because small countries like Iceland or Ireland, the situation there, the success in Costa Rica, if a little country, a tiny little country like Costa Rica or another one like Iceland can break out of the destructive system and have a responsible one that works on its own and be able to get away with it without the bombs falling, then bigger countries can do it. And if bigger countries can do it, then the biggest ones can do it. And everywhere it's tried, as you've written about, it works. It works. How do you back away from a system that works every single time it's tried? And the other system, sooner or later, fails. It's just ridden with my God, recessions, depressions, inflation, all of the horrors that cause so much grief to ordinary people. We're in America alone, the Federal Reserve this year, next month, the Federal Reserve is a century old, December 1913. The law passed during the Christmas recess. When the law went to Congress, you've written about it, Ellen, I've written about it.
Yeah.
I forget the exact date, but it was over the recess where Congress was leaving town. Few in Congress read the law. The ones who were there just voted for it. Woodrow Wilson, a law professor who understood the law, he voted for this thing, and he had the audacity after doing it, I don't know how many weeks or months later, he said, "I ruined my country." That's a direct quote, quote unquote, "I ruined my country." Well, that, my God, a law professor didn't know what he was doing. I don't know if he left town over the holidays. Could have taken the damn law with him. It was an awfully important law. You don't pass a law like this without, I don't think you pass any law without knowing what you're voting for. If I was in Congress, I don't know that I want to read 300 or 400 page bills, but if I didn't understand it, if I didn't have a team working for me that could go through all of this stuff in detail and tell me honestly what was in it and what it did, what good it could do, what harm it could do, I would never vote for a law like that. I would either be an abstention or I'd probably vote no. I would be an abstention if I didn't know, but I would really want a staff to be able to brief me, because nobody has the time to read all the legislation going through, but they have a staff, and what the staff should do is provide what the person in power most needs, and they certainly can explain what important bills are. I can't imagine any in the last century that was more important than the Federal Reserve Act. The harm that that bill has caused, Ellen, and I honestly believe if we could get out from under the present system, there'd be a very good chance we could either minimize wars or we could end them entirely, because the banks produce all of this money. Well, you know, private banks, but it goes to war profiteers. It goes to the banks, and the banks make so much money from wars. If we could only get out from under this, I think there would be a very good chance we could at least minimize wars, maybe would have a chance to end them, and just think what a wonderful world we could have. Banks that serve everybody honestly and equitably, and a world at peace instead of at war. What's better than that?
Yeah, well, half the budget goes for war. I mean, if we had a real democracy, the people don't want war. They don't want that much war, for sure. But we don't have a real democracy, and those are the conditions under which we had a revolution in 1776. So it does seem, but then, of course, we wouldn't want a violent revolution because they'll win. We have to do a peaceful revolution, and that's the hard part. How do you pull off a peaceful revolution?
Well, you know, we've had peaceful resolutions in different forms. We ended slavery without a separate war to do it. We got civil rights, and we got labor rights without a war to do it. There was some bloodshed, absolutely. I mean, people were beaten up on streets. They were put in prison. I'm sure some people died. But, you know, it was minimal compared to raging conflicts, the big wars that America fights. And these benefits were won. Of course, they've all been lost now. Discussed this on this program before a number of times, but they were won without a bloody revolution, and I think that could happen again, Ellen, if people would only realize and refuse to put up with the repression that's forced on them, if they'd only realize that they'll never get change at the ballot box. It is an absolute impossibility. I believe we need to rip down the whole system and start over again, but we need nonviolent civil disobedience, staying the course, and demanding change, and don't go to the polls every 2 and 4 years and throw out the bums, because all you get are new bums. You got to do it on your own. That's the only way it works.
Mm-hmm. I would agree, but it still seems hard to visualize how we're going to pull that off. But that's why I like the public bank idea, because if we could just set up another system, basically, I mean, it would be a whole local system, a whole go local thing, where in Switzerland, where I am right now, they actually do have representative democracy, and it starts locally in sort of local cells. I don't know what they're called, but, you know, in their local districts. And if you have your own publicly owned bank, that's how you get funding for your own local group, and that's where what you do with your public revenues. So anyway, if we had this whole separate model that existed, so we had something we could move into, then we're not dependent on Wall Street, and we can just let them fall. I mean, that's the problem in Ireland. Because they bailed out their banks, they actually wound up buying the stock of the banks. So now they own those banks, which have these huge debts. So it's very hard to separate out the people's interests from these debts that they now own. But I saw recently the IMF, there was an IMF study that suggested that the solution for the Eurozone, all the Eurozone countries, was a one-time 10% tax on all savings. Well, that's a bail-in. That's a blatant bail-in, where they're just going to bail out the banks by taking people's money, 10% of your money across the board. Quite shocking. So when people realize that when something like that does happen, it seems to me that's the point of revolt, where they're just not going to support the system anymore.
It can't come a moment too soon, Ellen. The conditions in Ireland today, 5 years after the crisis broke in early 2008, conditions in Ireland today are worse than they were when the whole thing started. So again, yeah, all they did was dig themselves a deeper hole. And if they don't stop doing this, a year from now it'll be worse than today. 5 years from now, my God, I mean, Ireland may... Maybe Ireland will be driven out of Ireland. I mean, it's a desperate situation where something has to be done to stop this. And if politicians...
It's amazing. One problem they have is that their young people are leaving. They're emigrating en masse. So they don't have... Their well-trained, educated young people just aren't there anymore. They're losing their population, just like they did in the potato famine. I mean, one reason, like you say, you have this huge... Irish population in Chicago, but they have huge Irish populations all over the world because they keep being driven out of their own country. And I think that's one reason that St. Patrick's Day is such a big thing all over, because there are Irish all over that have been dispossessed from their, or forced out of their homeland.
Well, that's
and
right.
And it's happening again. And the immigrants are coming in to get the free welfare, and the educated Irish young people are moving out. Quite disastrous for the families.
Well, that's why.
And I guess there's a rash of suicides, which they've never had before.
Well, I'm in America. I was born in America, Ellen, because my grandparents, my maternal and my paternal grandparents, never really knew my paternal grandparents, but my maternal ones I knew very well, and oppression drove them out of Europe. Not Ireland. My heritage is in Ireland, but it was repression, it was harsh living conditions, and they wanted something that was better, and they emigrated to America. There was the great exodus to America over a century, a 19th century, early 20th century, and my mother was the first generation in America, born in 1904, and my grandparents, I don't know the year my grandparents, maternal grandparents came over, but they came from Eastern Europe, and they came here. But again, if living conditions had been good, they'd have stayed there, and I'd be, heaven knows, I'd be talking from somewhere else than I am right now. Ellen, if I was actually doing what I'm doing now anyway, but I certainly wouldn't be doing it from Chicago. But this is often what drives people to other countries. They simply can't tolerate the conditions where they are, and they're forced to leave. If they want to survive, they're forced to leave to do it and go someplace else. And back then, America was the promised land. I don't know what people think about America today. I would think that many fewer people think of America as the promised land, just the opposite.
Yeah. Well, apparently the potato famine was not really a famine. It's from their point of view, it was a Holocaust, because they had plenty of food, but they were exporting the food to England. It was the British were in control, and they decided to they just imported all the food. There was a failure of the potato crop, but there was other food that was being exported that could have been feeding the people, and they contest that it was only 1 million. They think it must have been more like 4 million, because the numbers don't add up. So there was a huge, huge, tragic wave of starvations and disease and emigration.
Oh, it's horrible. Ellen, let's take a short break. Hold your thought. We'll come right back, and we'll pick it up. Welcome back, talking with Ellen Brown. Ellen, I just spotted an article that was sent to me by email. Occasionally I read the articles that a man by the name of Emanuel Wallerstein writes. I once had him on my program. He's abroad a lot, and when he is, he's very tough to get hold of. But I had him on, it was a good number of months back. Actually, probably a couple of years or so earlier than now. But he writes... I believe he writes two articles a month, mid-month, beginning of the month and mid-month, and his new article is titled The Consequences of U.S. Decline. I've read a couple of his books, and he made strong points in his books that he sees in the decades ahead, a totally different America emerging from the one that exists today. In his books, which were written some time ago, he said it could take 30 or 40 years for this to develop, and he couldn't predict whether it might end up being something better. It possibly could end up being something far worse. And in his newest article, he says this. Sounds a lot more dire. On the one hand, and he wrote this in his books, he believes that America's decline began during the Vietnam War in the 1970s. Maybe so. Gabriel Kolko, in his most recent book, which was written a few years ago, I've had him on this program too, it's been a good long time. In his most recent book, I don't have the precise title in front of me, he thinks America's decline began during the Korean War, if you can imagine that. And he wrote a couple of very important books on America's century of war and a new century of war, and I think what's called the definitive history of the Vietnam War. And it's a pretty dramatic statement to think that America's decline began in the 1950s, the early 1950s. Well, Wallerstein thinks the 1970s. That's a little bit more realistic for me. But I also believe that America is in decline. And Wallerstein says this in his latest article. He says there are two real consequences of which we can be fairly sure in the decade to come. So he's seeing big trouble before the end of the next decade. Then he says, quote, the first is the end of the U.S. dollar as the currency of last resort. When this happens, the United States will have lost a major protection for its national budget and for the cost of its economic operations. The second, well, the first, both of these are very important for listeners. The second one strikes home the hardest. And he says, the second is the decline, probably a serious decline, in the relative standard of living of U.S. citizens and residents. The political consequences of this latter development are hard to predict in detail, but will not be insubstantial. And the phrase I like to use, Ellen, based on what's going on the one hand, I talk about policies, bipartisan policies, that are destroying social America. Republicans and Democrats, most of them, are in lockstep in wanting America third worldized. I think that's a good way to describe it. Literally turning America into a replica of Greece or of Ireland or of Italy, which is in terrible shape today, or Portugal. I mean, these countries are in dire shape, and things are getting, Spain, things are getting worse, not better, and America is on the same fast track toward the same thing. So that when you and I grew up with Ellen, where there were certainly great opportunities, things were more affordable, school, grad school, whatever, a home was more affordable, things were all around much better than they are today, is steadily going downhill, both repressively, and you get these laws enacted to be on the books to go at people if they decide they don't want to put up with this, then you're ready to come back at them with police state laws that can be very, very harsh, and they have literally a plan to destroy the social fabric that America was built on in the New Deal, in the Great Society. Harry Truman's Fair Deal was Harry Truman. A New Deal, Fair Deal, Great Society. And all of that is being dismantled slowly. Well, you get a guy who calls himself a Democrat like Obama, and he is absolutely committed to ravishing Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. And he's actually come out and said it in rather diplomatic language. And I remember quoting him, Ellen, within weeks after he took office in 2009, he gave an interview to the Washington Post, and he basically said he lied. He lied like he always does. And he said how Medicare, he concentrated on Medicare, it's in big trouble, and unless we make steep cuts, the program will end altogether. Well, the solution
it absolutely is not. No, I mean, well.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I sort of missed who. I agree. There is a concerted effort. Is that the word? To turn the U.S. into a third world country. Who did you say is trying to do that? Did you read that somewhere?
Obama.
Well, yeah, but who's behind Obama? I mean, I agree. That the financialization of the country is what has ruined it. But I still, I guess I'm part Irish, and I still have that sense. You know, I mean, I still believe in my country for some reason. I still can feel that. I can hear that patriotic music that I still have that feeling that I had as a child, where I believed in all that stuff, like democracy and all that stuff that, you know, it still seems to me that we have great potential. We can pull out of all this. First of all, I don't believe that the dollar, that it makes any difference whether we're the international reserve currency. I think that's actually bad for us to be the reserve currency. As long as we have a central bank that will issue its own money, I think it's a good thing that the Fed is buying up treasuries. I know everybody thinks that's a horrible thing and it's an inflationary. It's not. Those treasuries are already there. They've already been issued. The Fed is not allowed to buy them directly from the government, which is too bad. They should be able to do that. But anyway, they buy it on the open market and with dollars. So now some savers that used to have their money in bonds now have dollars, and the Fed has the bonds. But the good part is that the Fed then rebates the interest to the government. So in effect, we are borrowing interest-free from our own central bank. Then that's the way it should be. And as long as we can do that, nobody can force our bonds force us to pay a high interest rate on our bonds the way that the Eurozone countries are stuck with these. Greece's rate at one point went up to 30%, which is horrible. No wonder they're totally devastated. 30%, I think your debt probably doubles in about 3 years. I don't remember the figures exactly, but you very quickly run up a very high debt. And the reason they're at the mercy of the bond market is that they cannot issue their own money. They can't issue euros, and so they have to borrow on the open market. As long as we have a bank that will issue our own national currency and lend it to us interest-free, we don't need to worry about debt. We don't need to worry about the interest rate interest rate on our debt. And we could get clear of all these other problems as well. I saw that Paul Craig Roberts wrote an article where he was arguing with Krugman about printing money and whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. And Paul Craig Roberts agreed that if you have more demand, that's a good thing, as long as you have products, you know, that if your money supply goes up along with your supply of goods and services, the prices remain stable. But he's saying, but our goods and services haven't gone up. But we're still number three in manufacturing in the world. It's not like we don't manufacture anything. The problem is that the demand, the increase in money, has not gone into the real economy. We've never tried that. And if we did try that, I'm quite sure that we could turn the whole economy around. If we just had like your basic social credit dividend, the government could just issue some extra money and in other words, do quantitative easing that goes right into the pockets of the people. That would work. If people had more money to spend, they would spend it on whatever. Even if they're products that are made abroad, they're still sold in the U.S., which means if you go to your shoe salesman and he's suddenly got a flood of customers, he's going to hire some more shoe salesmen. So that'll still add more workers. I mean, it'll stimulate employment, et cetera. As long as you have unemployed people, you can keep adding money to the system, as long as you're using that money to employ them. In other words, to do things that put people to work, like goods and services.
Well, I absolutely agree with that, Ellen, and I've said it so many times. If some of that money that was showered on Wall Street would be showered on Main Street, it absolutely would create jobs, it would put money in people's pockets, and as you've said and as I've said, when people have money, they spend it on goods and services, and that's what grows the economy. And if the balance between money available and demand stays in sync, then you can do it inflation-free. As far as interest-free money, Ellen, it sure ain't for you and me. It's for the bankers, but anybody who pays interest on their credit cards, well, I think it's a very foolish thing to do. I never have. Well, now I use a debit card. I don't use a credit card anymore. A debit card is wonderful. A debit card is writing a check without writing a check. It's so simple and easy. You just have to pay up right away. But I've never paid 1 cent in interest to any of the credit card companies in my entire life of having credit cards, which goes back to the 1960s. Not one red cent, and I can't imagine why anybody does it, because the rates are usurious. And everybody gets screwed so badly. Mm-hmm. So again,
I think they really don't know, though. That I saw there was a program on TV. It was helping young people who were in financial trouble, and so they would go through this, you know, with some counselor who would go through the books of this young couple that was totally heavily in debt and couldn't figure out how they got there, and they just didn't realize that. People get the sense that if they pay the minimum, that they paid for the month, when in fact, if they pay the minimum on that credit card, all the rest is going to go into a very high interest rate. It's a loan at a very high interest rate. So that's where your debt just goes up and up and up if you don't pay the whole balance every month. But the people just didn't understand that. I mean, they don't teach that in school. They should have basic accounting classes where you understand what your credit card means and what kind of trouble you're going to get into if you take out a student loan, et cetera.
And yet it seems so elementary, Ellen. I would say categorically, the single best, most surefire investment anybody can make with no possibility of losing a dime, how about that for an introduction, is paying off your credit card debt every month in full. In full, you'll save yourself, I don't know what they charge, 17%, 20%. I mean, they charge outrageous rates. In a zero interest rate climate, they're charging credit card holders these enormous amounts. And, of course, if you just roll over your debt month after month, it just expands exponentially. So, again, I repeat, the single best surefire investment is pay off your credit card every month and carry a zero balance. You cannot lose doing that. Anything else is risky. That is risk-free and marvelously profitable if you compare it to running up a huge debt that only gets bigger because you only pay the minimum, which is utter stupidity. And yet so many people do it, Ellen. And that's exactly what the credit card companies want people to do.
Yeah. Well, and then there's the problem, though. I mean, I'm in favor of credit cards. They're so convenient. And, of course, I use them all the time. And I do use my credit card instead of my debit card because I get free frequent flyer mileage. So I get lots of flights that way. But the merchant is paying, is it 4% that they pay, like at both ends of this transaction? And because it used to be that they weren't allowed to give a cheaper rate to people who didn't use credit cards. And so they raised their prices to cover that across the board. So everybody's paying for the credit card companies, whether or not they're using a credit card. I think just recently they changed the law I saw in New York, I think, where companies could give a better rate to people who don't use the credit cards. But still, it's a huge, that's another thing that if you did that through a public banking system, you could save a lot of money, or at least have that interest go back to the government. It seems to me taxing itself is a very inefficient way to run a government. A government should be self-supporting, and it could be self-supporting if we let our governments go into business, meaning if we let them run the banks, which, as we can see in Costa Rica, it works so much better when the government owns the bank. So that's the people own the bank, and the people get the profits from banking. And the Georgians say that the government should own the land, too. I mean, that all the rents from the land should go back to the government. I haven't looked too closely into that. But you can think of different systems where the government would be self-supporting, because everything that we call infrastructure, everything that we commonly own, I mean, the Indians would have said that land was commonly owned, or that the profits from that should all go back to the people to be used for the benefit of the people, for welfare, et cetera.
Well, that's exactly right. And public means public. If the government owns the banks, it means we own the banks. We are the public. But when private interests own the banks, I mean, you know, the big ones in America and in Europe, same thing. In America, it's Wall Street. In Europe, you've got the giant, huge banks, and they operate the same way as the Wall Street banks operate. And they're the ones who get all the benefits, and ordinary people get it in the neck. And that's the way it's always been. But especially under the system that we have now, where literally things are taken out of the hide of ordinary people to benefit the banks. So you see a country like Ireland, that literally there's a €75,000 debt on the backs of every single house. Is it every household or every person?
Or it's household.
It's every household. Well, €75,000 is roughly, I think a euro is about $1.30 now, something like that. So it's roughly $100,000 per person, a debt that households...
Per family. Yeah, but that's still, that's a modest house. That's a mortgage.
That's right. That's exactly right. And the difference between that and a mortgage is something that people take out voluntarily. This is something
and they have
are
a house
with.
To show for it.
Yeah, people get this locked on their backs, and they had nothing to do with creating it.
Yeah, it's shocking. It's really horrible. Well, when I was there, I recommended – I did this long PowerPoint that's actually on my website, on my blog, if anybody wants to see it, ellenbrown.com. But at the end, I had six different solutions, ways out of it. And one would be to just declare it an odious debt and don't pay it. And then people would say, well, you have to wait for a court, you know, and this would take a long time to wait for the international court. But you don't. Ecuador just declared, is it Correa of Ecuador, just declared that their debts, some of their international debts, not all of them, declared that they were fraudulently obtained and that they weren't going to pay it, and they didn't pay it, and they got away with it, and they came out the better for it. I mean, their economy is doing very well. So Ireland could do the same thing. I mean, they could just say, we're not going to pay until some court determines that it's not an odious debt, and then we'll think about it. That's what Iceland did, too. They said, we're not going to pay, and it went to court, and eventually the court agreed with them that it wasn't properly imposed on the people of Iceland. But they didn't pay it first. Instead of waiting on a court, which we all know could take forever, especially if depending on who's got the ear of the court, that the other side probably has the more expensive lawyers that know how to delay things.
I dream of a stampede of one country after another, Ellen, just walking away from their odious debt and saying, we're not going to pay it. I mean, there's absolutely nothing the banks or other countries could do about it. Absolutely nothing. It would start a stampede. There would be more countries that would join in, and it would be a way to literally get out from under this mess. It better happen, because I don't know how else it's going to happen unless we wait long enough for the entire roof to come in. I mean, sooner or later, this thing has a very bad ending. The real bad ending could be when people suffer so much that a threshold of pain is crossed beyond which people will tolerate. That's the making of a violent revolution, and that's not something I want to go through.
Yeah, that was the last article I wrote, was on the fact that Department of Homeland Security has bought 1.6 billion rounds of ammunition for,
yes.
You know, for what purpose? What are they going to use all those shells for? It's because they're expecting that at some point the people are going to revolt. I mean, it's not just ordinary terrorism they're thinking about, you know, like a random terrorist event here and there. They're expecting a real revolt when people en masse just get fed up and start throwing bricks through grocery store windows because they're hungry.
Well, the history of the world is a reflection of exactly that. I mean, there have been violent revolutions, a lot of violent revolutions in history. My God, we had the Russian Revolution, we had the French Revolution. The U.S. one was a little bit different because it was really elitist in America against elitists in Britain. And when the revolution was over, it was almost like the system stayed the same with just a change of management. And the founding fathers of America wanted to coronate George Washington rather than elect him. I mean, they literally wanted to make him a king, and maybe the one good thing he did, or maybe the best thing he did, was he said he wanted no part of this, and he only served two terms, which set a precedent, except for Franklin Roosevelt during World War II. No president has ever served more than two terms. So Washington did some good things, but the other founders, I mean, they wanted to make him a king. They wanted their own king right here, rather than a king across the ocean in Britain. So it wasn't the people's revolution, but other revolutions have been more people's revolutions, and they're generally violent, and America is no exception. America could have its own violent revolution, which means something very, very bloody, with a lot of people getting hurt, getting killed, getting injured. It's very, very disruptive, and there's
I hope it doesn't come to that, because they have such big weapons now. I mean, it's got to be really bloody this time.
Oh, it would be
so
terrible.
So I'm hoping there's a way to pull it off civilly instead of by war.
Well, the other problem is there's no guarantee how a violent revolution will turn out. Did not turn out well in France. Did not turn out well in Russia. They got rid of the Tsar, and they got Joseph Stalin. You know, it's like death by hanging or death by the firing squad. And the French Revolution, I mean, they got Robespierre and the guillotine. And that wasn't very pleasant. So things can be very, very bad. The same thing can happen.
Yeah, I guess if you look at it that way, it's kind of good that we're taking so long to pull off this revolution, because we really want it to be organized and civil. And so we have to have the right solution. I mean, I think the trouble with those revolutions is that everybody knows they don't want the existing system, and they're willing to get behind that and to overthrow the existing. But they don't have an idea for what's going to be better. So that there's a power grab, and whoever, you know, is the most powerful will get it. So ideally, you would do some sort of change where you know how you're going to affect this change. You know what change you want. It's an organized plan that everybody gets behind, and you just kind of peacefully throw the bums out and put in a better system. I fantasize. I dream.
Oh, I dream too. I think people don't think so much about democracy. They think about a good paying job so that they can support their families. They can have a home, a modest one maybe. They can send their kids to school. They can see that their kids are well fed. They can get proper health care to get the basics in life, the stuff that they don't have now. That's what people think about when they think about a good country, and they deserve that. And good governance can give everybody that. Again, it's so simple. If government works for everybody in the country equitably, we literally could have a fair system, but we certainly don't have one now. We're just about out of time. Ellen, a final thought.
Well, I totally agree with all that. And I mean, in my own mind, it seems so simple. I can think of how we could fix everything. But there are these basic principles that people disagree on. Like, to me, it's obvious that the government needs to issue some money and pay people to go back to work, just like Roosevelt did. That worked really well in the 30s. We should do that again. But people will disagree with that. And so the hard part is to formulate a plan that everybody agrees to. But I think there is definitely a solution that would work once we get all the little details hammered out. I think we're very close to the next millennium. I mean, the next golden age. It's quite possible, when you see all these wonderful inventions coming down, that it's quite possible to feed everybody, house everybody, and to have an ideal society.
It really is possible. A better world really is possible. And if private business isn't creating jobs and putting people to work and paying them, it's the responsibility of government to do it. And again, as you said and as I've said, Ellen, when people have money, when people have a job with a decent income, they have money, they spend it. Spending produces prosperity. It's a wonderful elevating a circle, and it's worked before. It can work again. We're out of time. Ellen, enjoy your stay. Have a safe trip back. I look forward to getting you back next month.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. Join us next Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.